are materialistic. But this is because they are Europeans, not because they are communists. Europeans, including Catholics and Protestants, capitalists and socialists, are the most materialistic people on earth. They accuse Americans of this vice, which is not ours, but theirs. Americans are, as Mary McCarthy says, quite uneasy about the things they so expertly create. We live among these objects, she says, rather than by them. However that may be, the Marxist continues to believe that the measure of human circumstance must be economic. He continues to presume that political systems are not chosen by the people, but rather conveyed to them by the workings of the absolute laws of economic function. Sooner or later, communists assume, everybody on earth will get his, whether he wants it or not. John Stuart Mill was not so certain of his grounds, nor of man's fate. He perceived that politics is not necessarily regulated by economic theory. He presumed that economic laws deal primarily with production and not with how goods are distributed. The citizenry, in fact, decides what to do with its labor, which is to say that they exercise political choice apart from economic forces. The distribution of wealth, Mill says, depends on the laws and customs of society. In his scheme of things, there are laws, but also chances and choices. He was a man, to use a famous line of verse by his contemporary, Matthew Arnold, who saw life steadily saw it hold. Watching the scene in the United States today, in Washington, in New York, in California, in Alaska, one observes our uncertainties. We are not sure how to determine what is happening, and we cannot agree, once we know what is happening, upon the terms of discourse. The result is a grinding repetition of arguments, inexact and vulgar use of language. The cause is, I think, the politicizing of the American people during the Vietnam War. Americans have always projected themselves as a political-minded people. Indeed, that Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, Adams, Franklin, and Madison, all of them cogent thinkers and superb writers in politics, should have legislated together during the founding of a nation seems incredible. The settling of the West was a century-long occurrence in which politics was dominant. Because of the West, the issue of slavery was brought to battle. Because of the West, the alliance between big business and government was first formed and later contested. Once the westering slowed, the immigrants flooded in, cities became the center of regular party politics. In short, politics has been thought to be a game that Americans play well out of long practice. But the fact is that the United States has been one of the few nations where a man can act in the public interest without standing on a political position. Most American businessmen and academics, and practically all physicians and accountants and engineers, have been little involved in party politics and little acquainted with political theory. The labor movement in the United States has been largely unpolitical, much to the despair of socialists. The American farmer cannot be trusted to be regularly partisan. All of this has now changed. The war in Southeast Asia changed it. This war is, in political effect, equal to the two other cataclysmic events in our history, the Civil War and the Great Depression. After each of these terrible events, Americans have undergone a period of intense and general politicizing. After the Civil War, the Confederate survivors organized against the blacks. And in the northern cities, the pattern of boss and buy politics was established. After the Civil War, the Democrats and Republicans became the established parties, although they were for a time made uneasy by the populists, who accused them of rote government. The Great Depression brought on the New Deal, which was the first mass political movement in the history of the United States. Now, I do not isolate and compare these three events, the Civil War, the Great Depression, and the Vietnam War, merely just for the sake of stating a thesis. Ask, if you will, any person over the age of 50, or again, any person over the age of 70, if he considers the First or the Second World War to have been as threatening to the continuance of the American nation as was the Depression. You hardly need ask about Vietnam. It is unique, and it is uniquely fearsome. It is the first war in which Americans, other than Confederate Southerners, will have been humiliated in a prolonged military action. It is the first war that has not brought prosperity, however temporary, to the economy. We witness right now a rise in prices and a fall in jobs, something never dreamt of in the philosophy of Adam Smith or Karl Marx or Lord Keynes. In politicizing the Americans suddenly, the Vietnam War has caused a widespread adoption of theory and dogma, leading some of us to accept the economic man and others the political man. Who are we who differ so broadly from one another? We cannot be counted, but I think we can be named. The old and the new left, the Maoists, the Leninists, the Marxists, and the old tired fellow travelers, believe that the existing economic system must end in the fall of capitalism and of an open government. The blacks, Indians, Americans of Mexican origin, and Puerto Ricans, on the other hand, seem not to disbelieve the power of the American economy. Rather, they distrust its longtime egalitarian promises. They fear they will not share in the bounty of American enterprise. And so they become political men. They want to legislate their progress. Then there is the middle class of America. It is so huge, about 60% of the population, that it can hardly be characterized. The members of this mass class are relatively affluent. They own some property. They have either reached up to their class or dropped out of it. But in either event, they are mobile. The mass class in America became politicized not because of politicians and political theorists, but in spite of them. It fears the Vietnam War not because of Senator Fulbright, who, it is well to remember, was the author of the Tonkin Gulf Resolution that gave President Johnson his free hand in running the war. It fears the war not because crude men are in power. After all, it was President Kennedy who sent the first large military forces into Vietnam and who knew full well what he caused all of us to risk. Rather, it fears the men in power have mistaken their constituency. A succession of American leaders has failed to recognize that the majority wants an end to the war precisely because the majority has lost so much. I think that the mistake has been made by politicians and intellectuals alike because Americans no longer identify themselves plainly and simply by income and occupation. The middle mass class now affects a variety of styles. Amongst them, there has been a loosening of attitudes, brought on mainly by the enormous effects of television. People now see themselves reflected in new images. They join national, not just local, communities of interest. Thus they become the youth, or women, or environmentalists, or the silent majority, or concerned citizens. Even so, they remain members of a whole and unique class, the only such class in history. Politicized though they are in the mistrust of the war, worried though they are by the rising costs of both government and business enterprise, they still do not choose the singular and dogmatic ideas of either political man or economic man. Indeed, they need not choose. They have themselves been. They are today the third man. The third man is an American figure. He is a libertarian, the revolutionary who bases his claims on constitutional guarantees that are almost two centuries old. The third man fulfills the prophecy of John Stuart Mill, who foresaw that it is possible to live in a free market economy and at the same time protect against economic predators by enacting and respecting laws. The predators on the poor, the predators on natural life, the predators on civil rights, including the right of a man to use his labor and his ingenuity to create and accumulate goods. What Mill foresaw was a social balance between a free economy and a regulatory government. The third man stands ahead of the economic and political men, and he may be, to use the dialectic of Karl Marx, the synthesis of the two. Soon there will appear in English a book by Jean-Francois Revel, in which this French intellectual says, quote, "The revolution of the 20th century will take place in the United States. It can take place only there. It has already begun to develop there. It will occur in the rest of the world only if it succeeds in North America." End of quote. Perhaps, like so many French ideologues, Revel is hoping that America will finish the French Revolution of 1789. It's a stock idea that the 18th century bourgeoisie began that revolution and that the people never were able to finish it, not even later in Russia or China, where the dictatorship of the people remains a dictatorship. But if America is in fact the crucible where the world's future is forming, it will not settle the old arguments of European theorists. The American Republic, as Jefferson conceived it, cannot complete a revolution, not even its own. Can go on and on in its pragmatical way, settling plain issues. The United States is the only nation in the world that is trying to deal with the issue of race on a massive scale. It is the only nation that is seriously contending with the issue of whether living space and food and shelter and health care can each be made a civil right without its use being dictated. It is the only nation that is debating publicly whether it can use its power justly, or even whether indeed it should use its power at all. It is the only nation in which the government will give money to create change, in which the government will foster as public policy a contravention of its traditional practices. And this, I think, explains most of the contradictions in the story of Leroy Jones in Newark. Teaching Swahili makes little sense, but can do little harm. Of course, thinking that blacks, out of some urge of racial memory, need to march collectively makes no sense at all, to blacks or to whites. Yet it is worth $37,000 to allow Leroy Jones and the mamas to play out their simplistic dogma. We can trust that at this time the people of Newark know well that they need more than absurdist theater in the classroom. They know they need private jobs as well as public forums, material resources as well as civil rights. The real issue is that the cities need money. If they cannot raise it, they must be given it. The point is that we can do what we will, and we'll do what we must. Domesticity is a plain virtue. If the world's destiny lies here, let us then begin our work at home. The third man asks not for the news, for he knows that it is bound to be bad. He lives in the present because it is the only time there is, and so he is neither a reactionary nor a conspirator. Refuses to wallow in old sentiments, and he knows that patriotism should always be a proposition, not a refuge. He can, as a civil skeptic, refuse to give credit to political obsessions, left or right, and he will not be rallied to run or to march. He can keep the promise of the American public, which is that orderliness and eventfulness are not opposite, but coefficient. Who is the third man? He is the American who is emerging from Vietnam, claiming nothing, neither chastened nor proven by fire. He depends not on the past, not on the future. He gets through the day, which is his day. The whole world is watching him, and he is me,
for giving us a very perceptive analysis and thought-provoking analysis of some of the most basic issues of our time, and providing us with a sweep of history to make an understanding of that analysis possible. I'm looking forward to an opportunity to reading the material which you have presented here today. And we are indeed grateful to you for honoring us with this.
We'll now have the conferring of associate and baccalaureate degrees. Dr. Donald R. Theophilus, Academic Vice President, will present the candidates for the associate and baccalaureate degrees.
Mr. President.
Mr. Vice President.
At this time, will the candidates for the associate degrees and baccalaureate degrees please rise? President Wood, my pleasure to present at the 49th commencement of the University of Alaska these candidates for the associate degrees and baccalaureate degrees in the various curricula. The registrar, unfortunately for the last time, has certified that they have fulfilled all academic requirements for their degrees. The faculty of the several colleges now recommend that they receive their degrees.
Indicated on the official program.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. By virtue of the authority vested in me as president of the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska under the Constitution of the State of Alaska, and upon the recommendation of the president of the university and the faculty, I confer upon you the associate baccalaureate degrees to which you are entitled with all the rights, privileges, and honors pertaining thereto.
Candidates may be seated. Candidate candidates for the associate degrees and the baccalaureate degrees will be called forward by the deans of their respective colleges. As the candidates receive their diplomas, we request the audience to withhold applause until the last degree is conferred for each college. Candidates for the College of Arts and Letters will be called forward by Dean Walter J. Mueller.
Candidates from the College of Arts and Letters, please rise and come forward. Sherry Marie Stevens, Associate of Arts in Liberal Arts. Melody Ann Erickson Zager, Associate of Arts in Liberal Arts. Thomas Edward Egan, Bachelor of Arts in English. Robert Evan Garrett, Bachelor of Arts, Journalism. John Stuart Hallam, Bachelor of Arts in English. Raymond Charles Harry, Bachelor of Music. Don Wesley Hildy, Bachelor of Music. Barbara Wilford Jacobs, Bachelor of Arts French, magna cum laude. Gayla Jacobs, Bachelor of Arts in English. Roy Joseph Minerly, Bachelor of Arts in English. Wes John Murdo, Bachelor of Arts German and History. Marion Pell, Bachelor of Arts in French. Philip Bailey Richardson, Bachelor of Arts, Speech. Marjorie Edith Shelby, Bachelor of Arts in German, cum laude. Lane St. John, Bachelor of Arts, English.
College of Behavioral Science and Education will be called forward by Dean Wendell W. Wolf.
Will the candidates from the College of Behavioral Sciences and Education please rise and come forward? Peggy Fortana Ashmore, Bachelor of Education, Elementary, cum laude.
Candidates from the College of Biological Science and Renewable Resources will be called forward by Dean Bryna Kessel.
The students from the College of Biological Sciences and Renewable Resources, please rise and come forward. Lauren John Zager, Associate of Arts, major in science. Ronald Clifton Anderson, Bachelor of Science, Wildlife Management. Robert Wayne Bunsen, Bachelor of Science, Biological Sciences. Robert Angelo Castoli, Bachelor of Science, Wildlife Management.
No.
Candidates from the College of Business, Economics, and Government will be called forward by Dr. Theophilus, Academic Vice President and Acting Dean of the College.
Will the candidates from the College of Business, Economics, and Government please rise and come forward? Eddie Lee Anders, Bachelor of Arts, Political Science, cum laude.
You know, it's not.
Candidates from the College of Earth Science and Mineral Industry will be called forward by Dr. Earl Beislein, Provost of the University and Dean of the College.
Will the candidates from the College of Earth Sciences and Mineral Industries please rise and come forward? Fred W. Sommer, Jr., Associate in Mineral and Petroleum Technology. How you doing? James C. Barker, Bachelor of Science, Mineral Engineering.
Candidates from the College of Mathematics, Physical Science, and Engineering will be called forward by Dean Charles E. Belke.
Will candidates for the associate and bachelor degrees from the College of Mathematics, Physical Sciences, and Engineering please rise and come forward? Gordon Philip Berberick, Associate in Electronics Technology.
Dr. Kenneth M. Ray, Vice President for Research and Advanced Study, will present the candidates for the master's degrees.
Mr. President.
Mr. Vice President.
Will the candidates for the degree of Master of Arts please rise? And will the candidates for the degree of Master of Fine Arts please rise? Will the candidate for the degree of Master of Arts in Teaching please rise? Will the candidates for the degree of Master of Education please rise? And will the candidates for the Master of Science please rise? President Wood, it is my pleasure to present these candidates for master's degrees in the various curricula. The registrar has certified that they fulfilled the requirements for the degrees as listed in the official program. The faculty concerned has recommended that they now receive their diplomas.
Thank you, sir. Sir, as president of the University of Alaska, I present these candidates for the master's degrees in their respective fields as they are recorded in the official program.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. By virtue of the authority vested in me as President of the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska under the Constitution of the State of Alaska, and upon the recommendation of the President of the University and its faculty, I confer upon you the master's degree to which you are entitled, with all the rights, privileges, and honors pertaining thereto.
As the candidates receive their diplomas, we request the audience to withhold applause until the last master's degree is conferred. Will the candidates please come forward?
Kathy Laird Carr Hankinson, Master of Arts, Anthropology, Linguistics, and Speech. Dr. Ray will present the candidate for the Educational Specialist degree.
Mr. President.
Mr. Vice President.
Will the candidates for the degree of Educational Specialist please rise? President Wood, I am pleased to present this candidate for the Educational Specialist degree. The registrar has certified that he has fulfilled the curricula, and the faculty of the college recommend that he now receive his diploma.
Thank you. Sir, as President of the University of Alaska, I present this candidate for a specialist degree, having completed all of his work for the specialist degrees as listed in the program.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. By virtue of the authority vested in me as President of the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska under the Constitution of the State of Alaska, and upon the recommendation of the President of the University and the faculty, I confer upon you the Educational Specialist degree with all the rights, privileges, and honors pertaining thereto.
Candidate, come forward. Larry Dale Labal. Mr. Labal received his Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Idaho in 1960, his Master of Education at the University of Alaska in 1970. Dr. Ray will now present the candidates for the Doctor of Philosophy degree.
President Wood,
Mr. Vice President,
it is my sincere pleasure to present the candidates for the highest academic degree awarded by the university, the Doctor of Philosophy. The registrar has certified the candidates have completed their curricula and recommend that they now receive their degrees.
Thank you. Sir, as president of the university, I take great pride in presenting this largest of all classes for the degree of Doctor of Philosophy in their respective fields as represented in the program. It's a great group.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. By virtue of the authority vested in me as President of the Board of Regents of the University and under the Constitution of the State of Alaska, and upon the recommendation of the President of the University and its faculty, I confer upon you the Doctor of Philosophy degree to which you are entitled, with all the rights, privileges, and honors pertaining thereto. As a badge of this degree, you will be decorated individually with the blue and gold hood of the University of Alaska. Welcome.
Will the candidates rise? Come forward. Frank Thomas Berkey, Bachelor of Arts, Linfield College, Oregon, 1962, Master of Science, University of Alaska, 1964, granted the Doctor of Philosophy in Geophysics. I'd also like to announce two Doctor of Philosophy degrees which were granted in absentia, one to Theodore Charles Loader III in Marine Geochemistry, and to Elwin DeVere Wood in Chemical Oceanography. Will Lieutenant Colonel Edmund J. Kennedy, 3rd, Professor of Military Science, present the candidates for the Army Commissions? candidates for commissions in the United States Army Reserve please rise and come forward? Mr. President, upon the recommendation of the faculty of the Department of Military Science and the approval of the President of the United States, I present to you these candidates for commission whose names are listed on the official program.
Thank you, Colonel Kennedy. General Rui, it's good to have you with us today to observe this ceremony. I have the honor of serving on behalf of the President of the United States, presenting each of these candidates for this commission in the Army of the United States. You have been selected for this honor because of special confidence is reposed in your patriotism, valor, fidelity, and ability. Now, to have merited this confidence is for each of you an achievement. And I charge you so to live and so to act that you may ever prove worthy of this distinction.
Second Lieutenant Gerald S. Cull, Corps of Engineers, United States Army Reserve.
I have the privilege
of addressing the graduating students. And each year is
something of trying
to know what to say. Each year is very different from every other year. The process of change on a campus is inexorable. This year I have written briefly on the American campus, a crisis in confidence. Class of 1971, yours has not been a vintage year in American higher education. A vintage year requires an abundance of sunshine, an absence of extremes in climatic conditions, and the proper nutrients at just the right stages of growth. Your time in college, unfortunately for you and the world, which you keep reminding me you did not create, has seen a heavy overcast of gloom-filled clouds and abnormally stormy weather. And at times, the storms have driven you to the edge of darkness, when the real purpose of your journey was to seek the light and a better way. Some few of you, it distresses me to observe, have not joined seriously in the search for truth and light, but impatiently have resisted and rejected the efforts of those who sought to give you a helping hand along the way. Only a few, to be sure, have so acted, and they should take no credit for adding to the burden of the rest of your generation. No credit is merited. For it is one thing to sound the alarm when it appears the engine is moving too fast in the wrong direction. It is quite another deliberately to try to push the entire train off the track. Throughout the nation in recent years, there have been the selfish and the misguided. There have been unreasoned actions of a few that have negated the hard work, the intelligent application of true ability to constructive tasks of the great majority of university students. The wild and wearied actions of a few have added much to inflationary costs in services, supplies, security, and insurance, not to mention the patience of the faculty.
general public is fed up to the gills with nonsense that pretends to be higher education. The institution upon which a free and independent people have relied so heavily and in which they have placed their absolute trust has been made to appear unworthy. And people have grown weary of disturbance, of unreasonable demands made by some few students and some few faculty, and they have turned from generous to marginal support of higher education for obvious cause. The general public is at the very brink of abandoning what it has long termed its wisest, most promising, and most enduring investment, its moral and financial support of higher education. Now, this is bitter, bitter medicine, and quite unnecessary for the hundreds of thousands of students and thousands of professional persons in higher education who have not been a party to the causes of disruption. Nor have they subscribed or succumbed to the wishbook philosophy of the restless, the emotionally volatile, the non-thinkers, the non-competitors whose only goal seems to be personal attention at any cost. If the profession of education is to avoid swallowing the entire bitter concoction being prescribed by the public, the profession must set its house in order as a learned profession. And yet there are elements in the fraternity that would move in the opposite direction and destroy the great gains in freedom, in prestige, in service to humankind that have been accumulated through generations of sacrifice and strenuous efforts by that same profession, higher education. The sorry fact surfaces that some who profess to being professors ought not to be associated with an institution of higher learning in any capacity. I say this on behalf of a besmirched and beleaguered profession, and in spite of the encouragement to discord and disruption provided by some members of the legal profession and by some members of the modern communications media industry. Raucous cries of academic freedom, of free speech, strident, arrogant, authoritarian calls for a new lifestyle, and pressure tactics from the underground demonstrators' handbook must not deter truly professional persons on whatever campus they may be from the unpleasant task of cleansing the nest. An independent, self-reliant profession of the learned cannot survive as a sanctuary for malcontents or haven